There should be a title slide, a slide that flips up first, and then we'll go to something about the history of the Christian Church after that. Well, while we are working on that, we'll just mention a few things concerning the history of the Christian Church, that it began at Pentecost. It began in its purity, except for Judas, and I think perhaps he had already committed suicide when the Holy Spirit was given. But then shortly after, there were other problems, even in the earliest church. There was a fellow named Simon the sorcerer, and then they had Hymenaeus and Philetus, who said that the resurrection was already past. However, they justified it. There was Alexander the coppersmith that did much evil to the apostle Paul. There was Diotrephes. We hear about him in John's epistles that he received not the apostles because he desired to have preeminence among the church. And over time, there were other problems that arose, such as redefining Christianity as not what you do and try to do, but whether you reject the idea that God was the Father and that his Son was Jesus Christ and that the Holy Spirit was their power and influence. And other things were added along the way until finally in 538 and 9 AD, the papacy was established as a civil government. I suppose we could go into just a little detail on that as to how it happened. Procopius is the only historian for that period, and he tells us that the Ostrogoths had withdrawn from Rome, perhaps it was 536 AD, but they were continuing to besiege it in 537 AD, and then in 538 that they withdrew altogether. And Belisarius, the East Roman general, chased after them, leaving the Pope in charge of Rome. And then the following year, 540, he was recalled to early, that is 540, recalled to Constantinople, leaving the Pope as the only civil ruler, really, in the area with much influence and power. So, it's at that point that we say that the papacy was established as a civil rulership. So things went down for the 15 centuries after Pentecost until we get to the Reformation. And then at that time, the various sinful events of the Dark Ages began to be exposed for all the world to see. And that was something which was progressive. Then, as we go along in time, of course, we get down to the 19th century, and as Brother Darren has mentioned, the French Revolution. And because it was in 1798 that the Pope was driven from Rome, I think it was February 20th, I wasn't actually there to testify to the date, in spite of what my grandchildren may think. But nevertheless, he was driven progressively north until in the following year, 1799, he was driven into France, Valence, France. And there it was that he died. And Napoleon managed to prevent any successor being elected in Rome. When they finally did elect a successor, it wasn't anywhere near Rome. It was the following year, 1800 in March, that up in the northeast of Italy, they elected a new pope. But among the Christians, the Protestants, they noticed that from 538 and 9, when the papacy became a civil power, to 1798 and 9, when the Pope was driven from Rome and died in France without a successor, that was exactly 1,260 years. And the brethren back at that time realized 1,260 days prophecies, 42 months, times and a half, that is 3.5 times, these all fit that period. And if that was true, then maybe by considering other prophecies like 1290 years, 1335 years, we might get some ideas on the Lord's return, on the resurrection of the sleeping saints, the beginning of the restoration of the Jews to their land. It stirred up a lot of excitements when they saw the connection with the prophecies of Revelation and Daniel. This is a beginning of a time when Rome is beginning to feel the consequences. We have two places in particular where Babylon's sins are listed. I think someone mentioned about it yesterday. Jeremiah chapters 50 and 51. And among those sins, they're listed graven images and idols. And it says there that in 51:17, that his molten image is falsehood. I think we can see a connection to history. And that in 51:35, there was the killing and the destroying of Jehovah's people. And then I think it's in 51:7 that it speaks of Babylon as a gold cup that made all the earth drunken. The nations are mad. Some of you may have seen a papal Roman coin in which Rome is pictured as a woman sitting on several hills. Yes, you count them now, they're exactly seven hills. And holding out her golden cup of apostasy for the nations to drink. You would think they would not have preferred to make that connection, but the coin was real. Then in Revelation 17 and 18, it says that essentially they loved this world's rulers rather than Christ. That's in the early part of chapter 17. And in 18 verse 7, it mentions that they lived in opulence or extreme wealth. The filthy rich, with money to burn, as our modern expression is. And so in 18:4, the church is given the command to come forth out of her and have no fellowship with her sins. We can trace that back to earlier as in the Old Testament as well. I think that's in Jeremiah. Just a little side note here, because I think we probably have a time to mention it. We see that in Zechariah chapter 5, there is a scroll that's given. And that given a scroll is a flying scroll. And it is for judgment for the false swearers and the thieves to consume. And we see that scroll mentioned again in Revelation chapter 6 and 7, even until the seventh seal is loosed in 8 verse 1. Of course, there we're seeing the outside of the scroll in Revelation chapters 6 and 7. As soon as the seventh seal is unloosed, then the scroll falls open and we get to read what's written on the inside. I think it's in Zechariah that it gives dimensions for the scroll. And that is 10 cubits by 20 cubits. This scroll is 15 feet wide by 30 feet long. No wonder no one was found worthy to open that scroll. But on the inside, we read these judgments of Babylon. So Babylon's sins are listed in Jeremiah chapters 50 and 51. One can go into as much detail as he likes on that. And then in Revelation, especially chapters 17 and 18, we can go now to slide 4, respecting the killing and the destroying of Jehovah's people. That raises the question, how many died in the Inquisition? Now, the Inquisition was to get rid of both Protestants and Jews. Now, there are different figures given for how many died in the Inquisition. one or two Roman Catholic sources say, oh, there are only about 6,000 that were actually killed in the Inquisition within a factor of two. And of course, that's if you limit it to just a few years of the Inquisition. And according to Philip Schaff, a moderate Protestant, that between the years 1480 and 1498, 8,800 were burned. That, of course, does not include all the years of the Inquisition. On the other end, a fellow named Rummel concludes that there were 135,000 that were killed, though less than 10% were actually sentenced. They were killed without being sentenced. Perhaps a reasonable one to accept would be a fellow named Lorenti, who says that from 1480 to 1808, 31,912 were killed, and 341,021 were, quote, processed, unquote. So who was Lorenti to say that? Well, he was Secretary General of the Inquisition from 1798 to 1801, so he might well be an expert in that period. The reported time frame, 1480 to 1808, suggests that he gave those figures after he was no longer Secretary General of the Inquisition. And then here's another source. This one that we find in volume two of the Studies in the Scriptures. It's quoted from the Catholic Banner. And Torquemada, 10,220 burned. 97,371 others were punished, for a total of 35,534 burned and 293,533 others punished. Considering the others that we've just looked at, that may be a fairly reasonable estimate, although the actual numbers will likely never be known, no, not in this age. Now, in all fairness, we should compare this with other things. Yes, there were wars, some of them endorsed by the Pope. There were the Crusades. There were the international wars in Christendom as well that killed hundreds of thousands and perhaps a few million even. But consider that in comparison with the 20th century. Now, when Rome is receiving her punishment, if we take just three of the great atheist powers of the 20th century, between Hitler, number three, Stalin, number two, and Mao, number one, collectively, they have murdered roughly 100 million in the 20th century. Perhaps that's why we see in Habakkuk is saying, Lord, you are sentencing your people. They've sinned. I know they've sinned, but you're letting them be punished by those who are less righteous than they. Why do you allow your people who have sinned to be punished by those who are even less righteous? Those who are more wicked. Well, the essence of it is the Lord responds and says, yes, I know, but wait till you see what happens to them. I hadn't expected to mention it, but I think I will at the time. In 2 Chronicles chapter 20, we have Jehoshaphat. And he is opposed by three enemies. They are related to the Israelites. They are not the Israelites, but they're related to them. Ammon, Moab, and the Ammonites that have conquered Mount Seir. They constitute a still third group. And they are coming against the Lord's people, and it looks like from a worldly standpoint, at least, the situation is pretty hopeless. But when the Lord's people begin singing praises to Jehovah, that is when the Ammonites and the Moabites gang together. The Lord has set liars in wait against them. Serpents? Don't know. Could be. But the Ammonites and the Moabites gang together until they have utterly destroyed the inhabitants of Mount Seir. And then they go to destroy each other. Until they have destroyed each other to the last man. And there's nothing left for the Israelites to do but to go in, take the spoil, and walk away again. This might suggest to us, the inhabitants of Mount Seir, that's used to be part of Edom. But it says the Ammonites have taken over Mount Seir at that time. Is this possibly what has happened to Rome? Already they have a leftist pope. That's something I never would have imagined the Day of Judgment. There are many Roman Catholics in the Americas that are very upset about it. And some have broken away, and some are just sort of acting a bit independently of Rome. But perhaps it indicates that the Roman power is first broken, and then afterwards, the leftist atheism and the Islamicists will destroy each other in Armageddon until there is nothing for the Lord's kingdom to do but to take over whatever is worthwhile. Now, we'll have to wait and see if this is just what it means. But the suggestion is there. And let us keep in mind, if the Lord allows that the power of Christianity is virtually destroyed before Armageddon, there is a consolation prize for us as Christians, and that is the world will not be able to blame Christ for Armageddon. There is much confusion in Babylon today. So let's go to slide number 5. Because of the difficulties that Christians are having, there have been attempts at religious unity. Now, why is that so more now than ever before? If I recall, back in the, somewhere in the 1960s, 1970s, somewhere in that era, there was a movement, particularly in the States, that said God is dead. Not meaning atheism, but the essence of the movement was that things were going great for Christianity, especially Protestant Christianity. It was growing and growing in the 19th century until something happened. And now we are suffering severe reverses. So their idea was, God was there, God was strong, but there's got to be something wrong now either with us or with God. And then they made the wrong choice. They said it's got to be wrong with God. He was very much alive, but it looks like he has died. Well, perhaps their God has died, but not the God of Israel, of the truth, or fleshly Israel. If we go back to 1846, there was an attempt at the Evangelical Alliance. Background for that in this country was the so-called Christian Connection, that they noticed the 1260 years of the papacy and said, well, it looks like it is time for us to withdraw from denominational creeds and accept the Bible as our only creed. They started out as Trinitarians, and most of them became non-Trinitarians. Whether as Arians or as Socinians, I cannot be sure, like Unitarians. But that bothered, of course, the major denominations. And also some of them were saying that there will be an opportunity for all. So the Evangelical Alliance was formed, and among their requirements, there is a triune God, or one God in three persons, as they expressed it. And one must also believe in an eternity of torture. So this religious unity went back already to 1846. And as things continued, it got worse until in 1893, there was World's Parliament of Religions in Chicago. Not just Protestants, not just Catholics, but Jews, Buddhists, Mohammedans, every religion that you can imagine was represented there. Of course, there were Protestants who wanted nothing to do with such a council. But that was held for 8 days from September in Chicago, the World's Parliament of Religions. Somewhat more recent than that, in 1948, they established the World Council of Churches. It was an organization which the World's Parliament of Religion was not. Not all Protestants agreed that that was a good thing at all. So in 1951, it was 3 years later, they established the World Evangelical Fellowship, which was the Lutheran response to the World Council of Churches. And then a more Presbyterian response, and after that, the International Council of Christian Churches. None of these has succeeded in uniting all of Christians, nor have they managed yet at least to have an association of all religions. But the willingness to give up the Bible as the one and only authority has led to political attempts to put together alliances of religions. We can go now to the next slide, number 6, the confusion that now reigns. And we can see the things that cause others to pause. What is going on in sectarianism? There are the separatists, those that separated, say, from the Church of England. And they say, how can Protestants, Protestants, how can Protestants unify with popes who persecuted you during the Dark Ages? And how can they compromise with Mohammedans, Islamicists, with Hindus? After all, the Hindus profess to worship the serpent. The Zoroastrians say, yes, the Hindus are the seed of the serpent. Then there are the nonconformist Protestants. And they say that Protestantism is dead because it no longer protests. And you'll recall in one of the volumes, it says that in a little bit different wording, that the ism is still with us, but the protest is long gone. Then there are the non-Christians. They say, you churches say that God has predestined most people to an eternity of torture, but then you try to tell me he's a loving God. That's utterly inconsistent. The agnostic says, you say you believe the Bible, and then you insist that everyone must confess a word that is not in the Bible. Like the word Trinity. I might add that although Martin Luther confessed to the concept, he acknowledged that Trinity is not found in the Bible. So rather than use it, he tried to create a new word to describe it, the word triune. And in one place he says, in his opinion now, although the Arians were wrong in one thing, they were very right. They refused to accept a non-biblical word as a standard of faith. And then there are the Jews. They will tell you, the goal of us Jews is to do good. Christians require everyone to confess a creed to be saved, whether they do good or evil. And their creeds don't even agree. Confusion, and various people within the Christian world and outside the Christian world see this incompatibility, this confusion in what we call Christianity. Now then, as we look through these scriptures, we see the seven last plagues, and I will suggest that's slide number seven, not number eight. At the threshold of Armageddon, it mentions in Revelation 16:13 that there are three unclean spirits that come out of the mouth of the dragons and the false prophet. So, who are the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet that are to be revealed before Armageddon itself, the final overthrow of the present evil world? If we look in the expanded biblical comments, which go up to 1916, there's a suggestion that the dragon is civil power. Can't be too bad. The beast is papal power, certainly very logical. A false prophet, Protestantism. A possible weakness in the last is that we have no mention of the false prophet until we get to the sixth and seventh plagues. On the other hand, the image of the beast is last mentioned in the first of the seven last plagues. So the question is, has the image of the beast morphed into the false prophet? One possible explanation, I say possible, not even probable, but possible would be that Great Britain, which may be considered by, I think, and probably a majority of us, to have been the beast that creates an image of the beast. The difference is that instead of the head of the church becoming head of the state, the head of the state became head of the church. And then that has continued up until the 20th century at least. But then what's been happening since that time? We see that some of the cities of England now have Muslim mayors. Islam is growing in authority in Great Britain. And London itself has a Muslim mayor who apparently could care a little about defending the Christians there. So is it possible that Britain will be taken over by, I think I've heard it said that in Europe, Western Europe, the situation is so bad that Belgium will probably be the first one taken over by Islam, with France and England not far behind. Well, watch and see. Could there be a rebound of Protestantism? Well, that's something I think that it's reasonable to watch and see. Now we go a little bit farther to 1924 and Brother Streeter, Randolph Elwood Streeter. I think he died in 1924, but in 1924 something was published of him in the book Revelation of Jesus Christ, suggesting that the dragon would be the Eastern Orthodox, the beast would be the Roman Catholic Church, and that the false prophet would be the Protestant Federation. There might be a little bit of a limitation on calling it the Roman Catholic Church, because isn't the church pictured in the woman who rides the beast? Well, the beast itself represents the civil power. But we will watch and see. Protestant Federation does not seem to have taken place. Today, if I were to look at the three great ideologies of the world today, they would be the atheism of the left, headed by Moscow in all probability. It would be today, although the Chinese Republic, if you can call it a republic, the Chinese Communist Party looks like it might be an influence as well. We just don't have Elam in the prophecies like we have Magog in the prophecies. Certainly the papacy and the Roman Church are powerful in this day. When Brother Ed Lorenz was vice president at Bank of America, he said that the Roman Catholic Church in the United States owns more than the four largest corporations combined. So it is not yet dead. But then would the false prophet be Islam, Mohammedanism? At the moment, those seem to be the three leading ideologies of this present evil world. But after we are through with the pandemic, will it change or will it remain this way? It is something that we should watch. I think it unwise to be dogmatic. Many have been dogmatic in the past and found that they really had to change their minds afterwards. As one fellow has said, we should season our words carefully. We may have to eat them. So these are three possibilities for what are represented by the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet, which we expect to see at the threshold of Armageddon. Now I think we can go to the seven last plagues, the last slide here. Little bit of background on that, and I won't want to go into much detail on it. But if we look at Joshua, when he went against Jericho, on seven successive days, he and the army circled Jericho once each day, except seven times on the last day. The first day began with Joshua rose early. Joshua, that's the Hebrew form of the name Jesus, very apt type. And so I think we can say that Joshua rose early would correspond to Jesus rising early at the beginning of the gospel age. And then there are 7 days where they go around Jericho, blowing the trumpets once each day, just as we have the seven trumpets in Revelation, picturing the gospel age and the seven periods of the gospel age. And the seven spirits of God that are sent forth into the earth to develop the church throughout the gospel age, just 7 stages. We won't get into what the stages are at this point. Last day, they circle the city 7 times, again, the priests blowing the trumpets. And that would suggest then that the last period of the gospel age in which we live is separated into 7 events or 7 periods of time at the moment. Now, the last day is introduced with, and they rose early. Well, if Joshua rose early on the first day, represents Jesus' resurrection, that the saints that had fallen asleep arose at Christ's return. And that begins the 7 last plagues that span the harvest of the gospel age. We will look at the plagues as given in the Exodus picture. It was the plague of flies, followed by the murrain that killed the cattle. There were blains on man and beast. Then the hail with lightning and fire and thunder. The fire ran along upon the ground, destroying the crops of Egypt that had come up, and that would be the barley and the flax. And perhaps 7 weeks later, approximately that, locusts come. And the wheat, the felt, which had not yet grown up, are now grown up, and the locusts eat up all of that. Then is followed by the plague of darkness. 3 days so that no man could move from his place for 3 days. And finally, the last plague, the one that delivers the Lord's people, is the death of Egypt, the death of the firstborn of Egypt. Of these plagues, 4 of them are deadly. 3 of them are certainly annoying, but 4 of them in particular are deadly. The murrain that killed the cattle, that's number 2 of the 7. Number 4, the hail with lightning and thunder and fire that ran along upon the ground. 5, the locusts. And they were brought in by the east wind, and they were ultimately driven out by a mighty west wind. And then finally, the 4th destructive plague is that of the Egyptian firstborn, the death of the Egyptian firstborn, where the Lord's firstborn are delivered. That would seem to signify the completion of the church, because they are delivered by resurrection. Well, now, let's compare these with world events. If we look at the 1870s, the Long Depression began in 1873. It was followed in 1874 in the fall by a fall planting that did not have a good yield in the spring of 1875. And ultimately, it led to the Ottoman Empire declaring bankruptcy and refusing to repay the nations of Europe their debts. So the Christian, so-called Christians of European nations against the Ottoman Empire. And ultimately, it led to a war in which the Russians were on the doorstep of the Ottoman capital, just 100 miles away. And so they sued for peace and well, to make the long of that one short, Benjamin Disraeli, then Prime Minister of England, managed to convince the Ottomans, look, you're broke. You need money. I can get you some money. I can find some buyers for this no good land in Palestine. And so the Pasha agreed to it. It's not a bad idea. And so that same year, 1878, the Jews bought land in what's now Israel, and I think it was November 3rd when foreign Jews actually came to Palestine and reached the site of what we call Petah Tikva, the door of hope. Now, some may object, what does Petah Tikva mean? They had swamps there, they got malaria, they had to abandon the community. Well, that's true. But that's not where the, because after they abandoned the community, then they came in with chemicals to kill the mosquitoes in the swamp, drain the swamp, and what's left, kill the mosquitoes in it. And so they returned to Petah Tikva. And I think Petah Tikva today is the 5th largest city in Israel. So indeed, it was a big deal. The Long Depression was followed by World War I. Ah, that was highly destructive. Tens of millions were killed in World War I. That would correspond well to the murrain that killed the cattle, second of the 7 last plagues. That was followed by a Great Depression, which was not a big killer. Terribly depressing, but not a killer. That was followed by World War II. And again, tens of millions died in World War II. It would correspond well to the hail with lightning and thunder and the fire that ran along upon the ground, destroying the crops of Egypt. And so we go to the next plague. the communist plague. State socialism, as they prefer to call it on the eastern side. The Cold War. And it was brought in by the East Wind, if we may call it that. And ultimately, after it had damaged the West and itself, the mighty West Wind did prevail. They called it Star Wars, where the West, the East, so that the East went virtually bankrupt. And that was what finally destroyed the Russian communist threat. Got to the point where whether they had been communists or not, they didn't even want to admit it. And some of you who lived in Romania or Poland during that time can appreciate that more than I. I was only a visitor. It looks to me like the sixth of the seven last plagues in our time is a panic-demic. That's the way I call it because of the political response to it. Now, they have spent all kinds of money that they don't have. And every time previous in history where that has happened, it has resulted in a depression. So I will expect that the result of this pandemic will be a deep depression. Now, it does say that the darkness lasted for 3 days. Would that mean that the major part of the pandemic will last for 3 years, last at least into 2022? Maybe even in 2023. That's something I think we'll have to watch and see without being dogmatic about that today. And then we come to the last plague, the Armageddon plague, no doubt about it being deadly. So if we line up seven last plagues of the Exodus with the world events that we've seen in the past 140, 150 years, they do seem to line up remarkably well, the deadly plagues and the not so deadly, however annoying they may be. Now, that's our subject is Babylon's ecclesiastical confusion. So what have been the effects of these plagues of Babylon? If we look at number one, the plague of the flies or the long depression, during that time, the Lord's people were called to come out of Babylon. Come out of Babylon, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. Now, it's important for us that we just not come out of Babylon and say, that's all we got to do. But the reason is that you be not partakers of her sins. What happened when Brother Russell died? Did they then partake of her sins so that the call continued? Come out of Babylon number two, my people, that you be not partakers of her sins. Now, before we think too highly of ourselves, it's true, Lot was called to come out of the city twice, but Elijah was called to come out of a city three times on the day he was to be taken up. So if we are not vigilant today, the call can go out. Come out of Babylon, my people. Come out of Babylon number three, that you be not partakers of her sins, and that you receive not of her plagues. Perhaps there's some convenience for the faithful church that those who would oppose the faithful church and the latter part of the 19th century were having a long depression, and therefore they did not have nearly the funds to put up a fight that they would have had otherwise had it been 40 years earlier or even 40 years later. Now we come to World War I. Some kings in Christendom. These kings were closely allied with their state churches. But what has happened to those kings, or in the case of Great Britain, Queen Victoria died shortly before World War I. We see that after World War I, none of the kings of Christendom had any real power. That was given to the prime ministers or whatever. So World War I, the kings of Christendom fall. During the Great Depression, there has been quite an effect on what we call Protestantism. It had now become two kinds of Protestantism. The so-called liberals, who didn't take the Bible too seriously, but the idea that mankind was going to evolve into a great society, and the Great Depression was simply a natural result of World War I. But after that, it would grow and grow and grow until the whole world would be converted into a wonderful kingdom that they could hand over to Christ. Fundamentalism during this time, too inflexible to handle the Great Depression, was only relegated to the very fringes of Protestant thought. The liberals were in charge of every major religious school, theological seminary. And so it didn't look good for Protestant after that. They were badly hurt by the Great Depression. But then comes World War II. Now the liberals are in trouble. Yeah, they can maybe explain evolving into a great society as having just one more thing as a result of World War I. But World War II is just as bad as World War I. So the fundamentalists made a sort of a recovery under a new label, and that was a neo-orthodoxy. It didn't deny the authenticity and validity of Scripture. It just didn't take a stand on it. But it was a reaction against liberalism. So someone has said that although fundamentalism in various ways was making a comeback, there is no likelihood of a return of the battle with liberals, because there were few liberals left to uphold the winning side. Now then, that takes care of the two major theologies of Protestantism. But now Roman Catholicism claims to be built equally on Scripture and tradition. Well, we read the Scriptures so that we know that they are not built on the Scriptures. But how about the Catholic tradition? That's one thing that the communist plague took care of. Communism was becoming a threat to the churches and to the nations, especially the nations of Christendom, that most of the nations in Central and South America wound up with leftist governments, and the church was on the run. The Pope himself was concerned because the northern provinces of Italy, from the west coast to the east coast, were controlled by communist governments, and there was danger that even Rome itself would go communist. And then what would they do? Where could the Pope go? Now, Ireland was a Roman Catholic country, but they couldn't afford to have him. America could afford to have them, but they were a Protestant country at the time. So Catholicism was really on the short end of the communist plague. It was the east wind that brought the plague into the Western world, and it was the mighty west wind, that primarily in the Reagan years, that drove them all back out again. Now, in our current situation, we see that there are still two things in which Rome and much of sectarian Christianity is still strong. Rome is very wealthy still, and there's a lot of support of lots of people, some of which is because they see the extremes of leftist atheism in the countries that are or have been communist. If the result of the pandemic is to be a deep depression, we can expect that sectarianism, the denominations, will be bankrupted by Rome. And Armageddon will take over the support of the people, support it. Now, we have mentioned these seven major world events, of which we have seen five for sure, likely are in the beginnings of the sixth. These are truly worldwide events. If we look back in history, the time of the flood, there have been pandemics, there have been wars. There never had been a totally worldwide event from the flood to the Long Depression of the 1870s to 1890s. And since that time, we have seen five major worldwide events, probably six with the pandemic. And Armageddon will certainly be worldwide as well. So I think we know that we are in the day of judgment, and we see that what is called Christianity is being judged unfavorably. Now, each of these seven world events that has contributed one major step towards the of institutionalized Christianity has also contributed one major step towards the restoration of Israel.